This is Community Campus Radio, CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Stream, podcast, or download program archives and more at ckuw.ca.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Be the first one to fire. Every man is a liar. There's just one kind of man who tells the truth. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Don't be a fool for a smile or a kiss, or your bullet might miss. Keep your eye on your goal. There's just one rule that can save you your life. It's a hand on your knife and the devil in your soul. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Like me.
Welcome to the Meta World Stoopaloop Show. I am your host, I am A. Karen Elliott. Today on the Meta World Stoopaloop Show, we bring you the 22nd installment of our series on data. I think for the rest of this stretch, we will have AI write the intros and then the super mechanical intelligence at the Meta World Stoopaloop Show Department of Super Mechanical Intelligence can give it come pointers. Like the kiddo Bookman says, I am the fast, you are the slow. Don't think we'll do that yet though. That would involve waking the dumb thing up and bothering to input some sort of directive, which would surely only elicit some sort of dry, canned, caseless words lop. Which is hat these things are mostly built on. So today on the Meta World Stoopaloop Show, Data, Part 21. On CKUW I am your host. I am A. Karen Elliott.
Thank you. structure that moves. And then you can manipulate the sound whichever way you want to.
Once the computer has been told what shape it desired and how they look from various angles, the designer programs in the movements to be animated. To solidify it, the designer literally imitates the effect of light hitting a three-dimensional object as it moves around within the scene. The necessary calculations are far too complex to be carried out in detail.
Visual world.
Many of the television commercials that are most successful today are ones that are like a dream. And you know, it does communicate to you subliminally. There will soon be a time that one will be able to tell reality from a computer simulated picture.
Those words were spoken by an electronic computer. They are an example of synthetic speech, a product of Bell Telephone Laboratories' research into the basic nature of speech. Knowledge developed through such research may be useful in devising new techniques for transmitting speech over communication systems. To make the computer talk, it is fed punched cards containing the names of speech sounds. The computer combines these sounds, in accordance with the linguistic rules which govern the English language, into connected, intelligible speech. For example, when the sounds for the sentence, "He saw the cat," are fed into the computer in sequence, it says,
"He saw the cat."
The flat, monotonous tones of the computer indicate an absence of the pitch and timing characteristics natural to human speech. When timing information is added to the punched cards, the computer says,
"He saw the cat."
The sentence still sounds unnatural, but when pitch information also is added to the cards,
"He saw the cat,"
the computer speaks in accents almost completely human, except for a slight electronic twang. In the following sentence, most of the variables inherent in human speech have been specified on the punch cards. The computer makes one of the pivotal remarks in the development of the telephone.
"Mr. Watson, come here. I want you."
The present quality of speech synthesis by computer is illustrated in the next example, part of a famous soliloquy from Hamlet.
"To be or not to be?" That is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep.
Singing, in purely physical terms, is essentially a matter of pitch and timing. In the next selection, the computer sings a familiar ditty.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer, do. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage. But you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
The computer now sings the same tune, but to a musical accompaniment played by another computer. Piano students will notice that the music-producing computer has a rather stylized left hand. Incidentally, synthesizing music on a computer is almost as formidable as making a computer talk.
Stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage. But you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
To get the samples of synthesized speech we've heard so far, a computer's memory was stored with 34 speech sounds and a set of rules for producing these sounds and for making the transitions from one sound to another. When the computer was fed the names of speech sounds on punch cards, it was, in effect, told what to say. But its manner of saying it, even its dialect and apparent accent, was determined by the rules stored in its memory. The objective of this program is to formulate a minimum set of rules for making plausible English speech. The next two selections, however, were produced by analyzing a person's speech and reconstructing it synthetically on a computer. The objective here is to duplicate the sounds and transitions made by a human speaker, including his dialect and accent. With such a program, the computer sounds like this.
Men strive but seldom get rich. Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to say a few words about Texas.
And now the computer would like to express its appreciation for your attention.
Thanks for listening.
Confederate.
What's a computer?
Laptop, computer.
What's a computer?
Computer illiterate.
What's a computer?
Laptop, computer.
What's a computer?
Computer illiterate.
What's a computer?
Laptop, computer.
What's a computer? What's a computer?
Laptop, computer.
What's a computer? What's a computer?
Laptop, computer.
Computer, computer.
I don't know much about computers other than.
So for some background, let's set the stage. Said was that there must be a correct answer for everything, and that there must be a knowable truth to everything. Modernism arose after the Enlightenment, and transcendentalism, and so modernism emerged in the West as an intellectual and artistic movement. But then postmodernism came about in the 60s in Paris, France, because the thinkers and artists and everyone realized, wait, there is actually no such thing as a universal truth. Because what's true in America is not true here, and it's certainly not true across the world. Things about like gender and sexuality, that's one of the biggest things that they pointed out, is like, wait, you know, the truth according to Judeo-Christian tradition in the West is that humans are monogamous and heterosexual, but that's not true.
It looks like it's game over, right? That's it. But you know, it's just a machine. It's just a machine, right? It's not conscious. It can do all these things, but it's not really anything. So, but the strange thing is that we're fascinated by this topic. There is not a single sci-fi movie that doesn't have a self-aware robot in it. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad, sometimes they're complicated. Self-awareness is a really complicated thing. I understand the creator of Westworld is here. Self-awareness can be very, very complicated. And yet, we've made no progress on it. And it's a taboo topic for reasons I don't understand. I started my career in robotics thinking I'm gonna work on one of these, on this big question. Surely, people have figured a lot of this out. And I Googled it, and the page came blank. When it comes to robotic self-awareness, all you get is sci-fi and philosophy, but you get ethics, but you don't get any substantial information about, is it possible? Do we have a theory? Do we know how to build it? What is it? In fact, as I was starting my career in this, the assistant professor 1,000 years ago, a colleague came to me and said, you know, you shouldn't be working on consciousness. You shouldn't be talking about the C word, he said. It's both fluffy and impossibly difficult, and you won't get anywhere. And as he walked away, he also told me, and you won't get tenure either. All right, so that was enough, and I did other things, and I, you know, try to make robots that do backflips and all kinds of other cool things, but it nagged to me, can we make progress in this thing? And, you know, and there's no excuses. We have computing power. People said, oh, it's just a matter of computing power, and they get self. No, we have computing power that's more than what many other animals have. We have a lot of other things, but we have no clue how to make this. In fact, if you look at Moore's Law today, this is gigaflops per dollar compared to 120 years. This is real data. It's embarrassing that we haven't made progress in this area. Look at where we are today compared to 2012.
Feeling and awareness. Now, replace those biological neurons with millions or billions of artificial neurons in a deep learning network. Could that vast tangle of silicon circuits one day flicker into consciousness? What do we mean by consciousness in AI? When we talk about consciousness, we usually mean subjective experience, the sense of what it feels like to be you. Computers today process inputs and produce outputs flawlessly, but they don't report inner experiences. Question, is that because they lack the right structure, or because they fundamentally can't feel? Can sheer complexity spark awareness? Some thinkers propose an emergence view. Once a system reaches a certain threshold of interconnected processing, so many layers, so much feedback, it spontaneously gains awareness, much like heat emerges from random molecular motion in a hot pan. In this picture, next-generation AI models with trillions of parameters might brush against that threshold, birthing a flicker of self-reflection. But skeptics ask, if we doubled or tripled existing models, why haven't we already seen so much as a hint of inner life? What ingredients might be missing? Complexity alone may not suffice. Biological brains have qualities AI lacks. Embodiment, our senses ground us in a changing world, giving rise to unified experiences. Emotion and motivation, feelings guide attention and learning, binding memory into a lived narrative. Integrated feedback loops, the thalamoconical system in mammals constantly loops information.
This ambiguity is you have this idea that there are multiple gods that run concurrently on subsets of the population. They might even have physical wars against each other. They're enacted by wars between the people that are the hosts of these gods. And a big innovation was tribal monotheism, as exemplified in Abrahamic religion. In tribal monotheism, you have only one god per tribe. And you have a hierarchical way in which this god is defined. So it's basically the same for the tribe and has the same functional properties. And it gets the power to control you. That's why in Genesis 1 it's identified with this first consciousness that runs on your mind. And so basically it works by synchronizing the motivation of the members of the tribe across the tribe. And your god becomes the spirit of the tribe. It's a total god that is eliminate all the competing gods within the tribe. And it's hierarchically synchronized, and it acts for the benefit of the tribe. And this allows the tribe to compete more efficiently with other tribes, which might have a different tribal god. But what happens if we make this god more general?
Idea what intelligence is, it's creating something that's never been created before. How do you measure creativity? That's a really valuable thing. Well, okay, a human, create something. Nah, creativity level very low. Like, what? Right? Well, maybe it's too close to what's been done before. I mean, how do you measure the... You need more randomness. It has to be more different than what you've done before. Okay, well, you'll just create something you've never done before. There's a game you play where every word you say, you go around the circle, and every word you say has to be extremely different from everything said before, so you're kind of trying to... It's kind of a fun game. So you say apple, and you can't say a fruit or anything that's apparently an apple or green or red, so you say... jealousy. Okay, apple jealousy is different. All right. So another word, like can't be the same as apple. So it's a kind of that's where creativity comes in, right? So it's kind of a fun game to play. Anyway, that's a little game that computers can try to do and not do very well at.
Next to each other, communicating with each other. I thought of one maybe as George and the other as Sam. And they're talking to each other, and you walk up and you say, "Hey, George, what are you talking about?" Well, from the time you started knocking until you finished asking your question, George has already said to Sam more words than all the utterances of all the humans that ever lived. So the question is, well, what would it say to you?
This is how the computer sees the human brain. The intelligent machine that enabled our ancient ancestors to survive in their brutally dangerous world. The brain's rate of evolution is extremely slow, although its intelligence has stretched to its limits to produce some incredible achievements. By contrast, the dangers of the world have begun to evolve explosively fast. The human brain may not be intelligent enough to cope for much longer, unaided. This is how the human brain sees the computer. The computer's a calculating machine whose rate of evolution is immeasurably more rapid than the brain's. Born less than 40 years ago, the computer has already developed from a cumbersome machine driven by valves through four evolutionary generations. Valves to transistors. Transistors to microcircuits. Microcircuits to integrating circuits. Each generation becoming more compact and far more powerful. The 1980s have already seen a tremendous acceleration in computer development. Now, an international race is on to make computers not only more powerful, but highly intelligent. The Japanese have a government-sponsored crash program to develop a fifth generation of computers. They expect this fifth generation to help them solve ever more complex, multifaceted social problems, including, but not limited to, transition to an elderly society. Never before has a computer attempted anything so profound. we seem to be witnessing the spawning of a new kind of intelligence. Artificial intelligence. Already, many computers are behaving like infant prodigies. What will they do when they grow up? Faced with such a rapid rate of evolution, it would be reckless for us to make any predictions. But it would be madness not to try. Fortunately, the frontiers of research in artificial intelligence are manned by computer scientists who are more than ready to forecast the impact of their work on human society. First, Professor Edward Fredkin.
I think that the artificial intelligence in the future will be worried about weighty problems that we simply can't understand. And they may condescend to talk to us. They may amuse us on occasion or play games with us.
It's about thinking about what is the best possible, most top-level collective agent. It's an open-ended process that requires a lot of thought, and it's not going to be finished anytime soon. And it's enacted, this end agent, by all those people or individuals who recognize this entity and decide to serve it. And this leads to the harmonic organization of a civilization. According to Aquinas, we can understand individuals as rational agents. And a rational agent should basically follow policies for organizing itself. Aquinas identifies individual policies for rational agents that he calls the practical virtues. For instance, a rational agent should always optimize its internal organization, which he calls temperance. And it should optimize the organization to other agents, which he calls justice, right? Keep the books balanced. And you should pick goals and strategies that you can rationally justify, which he calls prudence. And you should be willing to act on your models, get the right balance between exploration and exploitation in your strategies, which he calls courage. But these rational strategies do not, by themselves, lead to a harmonic society. To do this, you need collective policies. And Aquinas sees society as a multi-agent system. And you get the optimal social organization by creating a collectively enacted agent. And this collectively enacted agent emerges over three policies, according to Aquinas. The first one is you do need to commit to serve the optimal collective agent, which he calls faith. And then you need to do this not by yourself, but together with all the others that serve these sacred purposes above the ego, which is called love. And you need to be willing to invest into that thing before it comes into existence, because otherwise it will not exist, right? If you wait for it to exist so it can reward you, it will never happen. And this willingness to invest into it before it exists is what he calls hope. These are very rational policies for collective agency. So when we define God as the best possible, most top-level agent, and we commit to serving this transcendent agency.
And in some sense, they might keep us as pets.
Another scientist in artificial intelligence is Professor Joe Weizenbaum.
It has been said, especially here at MIT, that computers will take over in some sense, and it's even been said that if we're lucky, they'll keep us as pets. Arthur C. Clarke, the science fiction writer, remarked once that if that were to happen, it would serve us right. The question I have about that is were these us who it would serve right? Do you have to recall that there are, to be very, very generous, say 1,000 people in the world who are working on these things, and without having asked anyone else. And if it turns out that if they produce the monstrosities that are being forecast here, then it'll serve us right, not the rest of us. I think this says something about the whole question of responsibility in science.
Responsibility in science, or science fiction? If we're not to be blown off course by wild-sounding predictions, we'd better anchor ourselves in familiar waters. 1959, and the first time computers impacted on society was when Northwest Gas was going to issue their gas bills. Soon, all the public utilities followed. Like babies learning to walk, computers fell over themselves again and again. Artificial intelligence, computers were obviously idiots, certainly no match for their human masters. We don't see things like that anymore. Now we rely on computers in every walk of life, and even school children carry around calculating power that would once have filled a room. Today, computers do everything for us, from flying aircraft to playing games. By contrast, work in artificial intelligence is virtually invisible. It's all a matter of computer programs. But computer programs are gobbledygook to anyone but the specialist. And like the human brain, the computer is an inscrutable machine. From the outside, it's downright boring. A video display unit is a video display unit, and a computer is a shiny tin can. We can only keep watch on what's going on inside through talking to the people who work with them.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Myers. The nurse tells me that you feel quite weak.
Dr. Jack Myers is a consultant with the University School of Medicine, Pittsburgh.
Well, diagnosis is often the most difficult part of medicine. It's getting more difficult because of the vast extent of medical knowledge and the number of diagnostic possibilities that must be entertained. So about a decade ago, we arrived at the idea that the computer, with its almost infinite memory and ability to correlate many things simultaneously, would be a help as a diagnostic consultant. We have about 600 diseases profiled now, and each has about 125 manifestations, and then we have to put several values on each of those. I made a rough calculation the other day that an internist, if he's to contain this medical knowledge base, which we have, would have to know 225,000 facts. In my own computer up here, I don't retain 25% of that information. So I don't have to make any personal apology. Why not put it into the computer and use it appropriately?
The program has put together a number of diagnostic possibilities to account for the...
Harry Popel, one of a new breed of computer specialists known as knowledge engineers. He spent 10 years painstakingly analyzing Jack Myers' lifetime of experience and putting it into a computer program. And not just Dr. Myers' experience, the computer has digested a whole medical library and the most up-to-date medical journals. Harry starts by feeding in all the information Jack has gleaned from the patient. Already there's some confusion. The patient's symptoms seem to be contradictory.
Harry, we're doing this computer consultation because this is a problem case. As you can see here, there's some changes in kidney function.
The computer, however, doesn't see it as a problem case. It swiftly scans through all the patient's symptoms, then it finds out which combination of most symptoms corresponds best with anything in the libraries of medical practice it's been programmed with. That's a lot of computer processing. But in a matter of seconds, the program arrives at a diagnosis with a sureness that would be beyond one single consultant.
Well, I wouldn't be sure, but the system says it's sarcoids. It doesn't have any trouble. It said, well, you know, I'm sure it said internally, it would be nice to have the big liver, the big spleen, and the big lymph nodes, but this combination of evidence is just so strong that...
So even though some of the classical symptoms a doctor would look for were absent, the computer correctly diagnosed the patient's disease as sarcoidosis. But what about the contradictory symptoms that didn't fit?
Now the system wants to know about the patient's blood pressure.
And so the computer program puts out feelers to the outside world to get the extra information it needs to find what else the patient is suffering from. Watching the interchange, it's easy to form the impression that the computer program is intelligent. But is it? The computer it's being run on is 2,578 miles away at one of the citadels of artificial intelligence, Stanford University. Head of the computing department is Professor Edward Feigenbaum. Is the Pittsburgh computer program really intelligent? Feigenbaum is pragmatic about it.
What I observe is that one can make a program...
But it's all around us. We're using it the whole time. That was the last time. No,
saying, hey, we know what her name is. And we'll talk about the gender nature of that as well, actually. Chris, that's a great summary of where we are now, but it is in all sorts of fields. What do you see a lot of it, especially on the really cutting edge side. What are you most excited by in terms of the applications of AI?
Well, I think we've seen huge advances even just in the last couple of years or so, and it's sort of become ubiquitous. So there are many, many places that AI shows up in our daily lives that we don't know about. I mean, I think Arthur Clarke, the science fiction writer, once said, the best technology is ones that disappear into the background. They help you in your daily lives. You're not aware of it. So it's just all sorts of things like, opening your phone with your face or translating from one language to another on a website, or just many, many, many examples of this. But I do have a real sense that and I've been in the field for about 35 years. I mean, the field has been called machine learning that I've been in, and rather than artificial intelligence, but it's really machine learning has really become the dominant approach to artificial intelligence. And really, just in the last year or two, we've seen just extraordinary advances to the point where I think the next few years in particular will see some very rapid changes. I think coming back to Catherine's excellent description of artificial intelligence, it's a slippery fish, it's very hard to define. I think there are many different axes to intelligence, different kinds of intelligence. And some of these, in terms of artificial intelligence, are progressing very rapidly, and others are making slower progress. Others have almost been solved, in effect. So really, the way research progresses, it doesn't progress uniformly on all fronts. There are certain areas that are very exciting. The field that I'm particularly excited about is the impact of machine learning and artificial intelligence on the natural sciences, on chemistry, physics, biology. This is a very exciting field. It's such an exciting field that I've actually pivoted my career, started a new role, building up a global team in this space, because we think that machine learning will have a big impact on our ability to model and simulate the world with many applications.
So a number of things flow from that. And so by evaluating with Socratic reasoning, they said, okay, you made this premise, is it always true? No. Okay, let's move on. So from that, postmodernism emerged, which basically says, nothing is true, there are no universal truths, everything should be questioned. And that's where we are today. We are still mired in postmodernism, where the prevailing belief is that there are no truths. That is considered a first principle, is that there is nothing that is true, it's all relative. It's a very frustrating thing, but it does have its value. We're also mired in nihilism. So part of what has happened is, ever since the inventing of the printing press, the church has had less and less power. Because of this move towards intellectualism, because the church no longer had a monopoly on thought and writing, things began to be evaluated, and so you had people like Martin Luther and Protestantism, and this repeated fracturing of the church, which kind of had a monopoly on morality, amongst other things. But also, it had a monopoly on philosophy. Well, at the end of the 19th century, there was a lot of intellectual movements about, like, okay, what is it that's true? Humans have a really hard time of breaking away from the schemas on which we are raised. And so a lot of people in the late 19th century and throughout the 20th century, such as Eugene Rose or Saint Friar Seraphim, were raised with religion, and they could not break away from this God-centric view of the world. And so, but if you get rid of God, if you get rid of this all-powerful being, this all-loving being, and you're left with nothing, then you inevitably come to the conclusion that nothing matters, everything is meaningless, which is a really, really awful place to be. So that's what nihilism is. Now, this book really bends over backwards to promote the idea of positive nihilism, or optimistic nihilism, which basically says, you don't have to fear hell and damnation, and you don't have to impress this omniscient God, so therefore you're free to do whatever you want. That falls flat because humans need purpose. We'll get into purpose in a little bit with the genius myth. So basically, Eugene Rose, he tried to get away from a religious mindset, and then he literally opens the book by talking about how he became a bohemian and he was in with the postmodernists, but he was so cripplingly depressed because he had no purpose in life that he ended up just laying on the floor drinking himself to death in a studio apartment in New York, or a basement apartment in New York, just like laying on the floor screaming about how lonely he was. And so he went back to religion and basically did a 180 and said, nihilism and postmodernism are wrong. It's a tool of the devil. We all need to go back to religion. That's his view. So postmodernism and nihilism are at the root of a lot of these discussions. We are in an age of scientific inquiry and empiricism. So empiricism says that everything must be observable. There must be some physical phenomenon at the root of everything. This is also called materialism. So materialism says that like whatever goes on is a result of matter and energy, and that includes consciousness. So then we've got, let's see, where did it go? Chalmers, a popular modern philosopher, is kind of in the materialist school of thought, where you know he looks at which regions of the brain, give rise to certain things. But he remains just a philosopher. So if you want a hardcore materialist,
or maybe do very well, depending on how you want to measure that. And then general intelligence, understanding kind of common sense stuff. We'll talk about that and show some things like that. So, planning. Now, you might recognize this slide. This slide is from my games lecture, and I realized, wow, this is a perfect slide to talk about it, because what it gets to is when you're thinking about planning, and this is just planning of, let's say, you know, a single one-dimensional point getting from A to B in some maze, say, even a 2D maze, there are, I think, three levels of what I would call intelligence. I could have a simple thought. I could have a BYOB script navigate a 2D maze by doing what? Well, one thing you could be doing is simple heuristics. As I'm moving forward, if I have an obstacle in my way, move around it. But I have no idea of the whole world. I'm always like looking ahead. It's almost like a sensor that all I can see is a fog, and I can see a little bit ahead of me, and if I bump into something, kind of back up and turn around. And in fact, you can go to Radio Shack and buy these little robot thing that if it hits the front, will back up and kind of rotate left by 15 degrees and go forward. That's intelligence in some sense. It's able to go do that, right? You can imagine that. The next level will be pathfinding. And pathfinding is there's a whole field of search. There's essentially a tree that gets formed, which is, I start where I am, and I kind of look at all the possible paths. This is a graph also, of where I can go, and I need to get to the top, and I start at the bottom, and I am using one of many, and this might be a really big graph, so how I search that graph is pathfinding. And there are many techniques, a ton of techniques, a lot of kind of the middle part of AI, almost like the growing field of AI, was thinking about search, how to search optimal, and how we evolved from basic search to what's called British Museum search, which is I just hit everything. The idea of British Museum, I'm guessing, from the idea is that you're not given a list. You want to visit some painting in the British Museum, but you're given no menu, you're given no map. You know, no, you are here, and so how do you visit it? Well, you put your right hand on the wall, and just keep walking, and keep your right hand on the wall, and then you walk into every nook and cranny, including the bathroom, including the storage room, until you find your painting. It's not using any intelligence at all, because there's no knowledge of where you need to go to, how close you are from your goal. Then you have very simple depth-first versus breadth-first searches, and then you have more sophisticated alpha-beta searches.
They would say they don't have enough computing power, but we do. What is it? What's missing? We have made incredible progress in deep learning, and we can tell the difference between a cat and a dog, and all kinds of amazing things that have transformed every aspect of every industry and every market. But we're no closer to making intelligent, self-aware machines. Sure, we can make robots that can do backflips and incredible things, but nobody would claim that this robot is happy having accomplished this thing. It's not even enjoying this. So what is it about emotions, and can we do this? Some people tell me, okay, it's about art. Robots are not going to be self-aware until they can create art. Although somebody told me a little bit high, I think, you don't need to be self-aware to create art. It's interesting, but I built a robot that case. It's a robot I have in my living room.
and it creates art. In the beginning, it wasn't very good, but it's learning. It's creating pretty amazing thing on its own. This is a painting of my cat right there, created by this robot. I cannot paint my way out of a paper bag, so I'm not teaching it how to paint. It's learning on its own. It's actually on a, it's walking through New Delhi right now in Google Street View. I don't know what it's going to paint when I come back home. So it's kind of interesting to see. But people, it creates art, but it's still not anywhere close to sort of enjoying the art, right? I recently gave a talk in Brooklyn about robotic art, and I was booed off the stage. Not because I said my robot creates art, but because I said my robot was an artist. Because there's something that we hold very dear about creativity and about emotions. And this idea that a machine can have emotions is almost sacrilegious.
Here in Pittsburgh to the Pacific Coast, the knowledge-based expert systems industry. For example, hard at work at Stanford Research International is one of America's top geological prospecting consultants. This particular prospector recently struck it rich.
On the basis of the information you gave me, I would consider the possibility of corporate governance in type A. Which are you?
Again, the expert consultant is not the man, it's the computer program. The program's called Prospector. Its expertise is based on a huge fund of geological knowledge that's been built into it. Now the program's asking for some more information about a possible mining site.
To what degree do you believe that the target area is in the continental margin of the belt? Now what the hell is it asking me about that for? So why?
Dr. Ribot can't follow the computer's line of reasoning.
Trying to establish the Pittsburgh city.
Fortunately, Prospect has been programmed to explain its thinking. This is no gimmick, it's a matter of trust.
No human professional will look to a machine for assistance in human professional work.
Max, you're trying to optimize something in A-Star, you have a whole level of these progressive deepening is another modification of that. These are ways that you can kind of narrow your search field to try to get to where you are if you know a distance from you and the goal. Pathfinding is a whole field. And the high end of this, you can imagine someone who, and this is in a kind of competitive situation, actually learns from the player. So I want to do a path, but I've learned that maybe in the past I've gotten stuck down this pathway, or that didn't work, or when I went there I got shot, or I was able to score a lot of goals that way. So I can learn from the player or from my old experience and influence what I'm going to do today. So that's a kind of a learning piece of that. And this is all from the old, I won't talk, that's all from the old slide. I just want to keep this old slide together. But it's kind of cool. I can bring the old slide up and bring up the idea is that planning is a big part of what intelligence looks like. So if I had, you know, you want to have a good opponent in many games. And so AI obviously factors into that, which is why I brought up the AI in the games lecture. All right, first peer instruction question. The world's best AI StarCraft player is from... By the way, my name is not Armando Fox, so it may not be the obvious answer that Armando's answers always were, but just keep in mind that we're different people. So, what do we got? And let's get everybody here to vote. Let's come and bring it all out. I should have at least... We had 81 exams, 82 exams, Luke, in the midterm?
Thereabouts. 80s.
Are all the students taking it, by the way, at this point, or is there still one left?
Black boxes won't sell. Inscrutable okay, devices won't sell.
Okay, we'll race. All right.
Feigenbaum's responding to the challenge.
50 people, that's about right. 50, and how you doing here? Okay, Bink, and there, and happens at Burke.
...based expert systems. Prospectors digested tomes of theoretical geology. Here it's being fed practical information from maps of actual prospecting sites. The program now knows more than any single living consultant. But can it take that intuitive leap that's the hallmark of the human expert? Well, the prospector does better than that. It converts the art of expert guessing to sheer mechanical logic.
And at Mount Tolman, this new brand of expertise finally paid off. Prospecting data gathered from this possible mining site in Washington State was handed over to the computer to analyze. Prospector confirmed they'd probably find molybdenum there. Valuable mineral. They did. $100 million worth. Bang in the center of Prospector's final map. Expert systems are now in demand in scores of applications because they make the know-how of whole teams of experts instantly available. But does that make them intelligent? Head of the department that produced Prospector, Professor Niels Nielsen.
There's this saying about computers that garbage in, garbage out, that you can't get more out of a computer than you put in. And that's probably quite true. However, the consequences that people like to draw from that are sometimes a bit misleading. I think it's better to say something like pearls in, pearls out. And what we're exploring really in artificial intelligence are techniques for putting those pearls in. We can in fact say quite a bit to a computer. And it's insane, quite a bit to a computer, that we get a computer to perform intelligently.
At the University of California, Professor James Meehan is one of them.